A week is a long time in politics, so a few months is like an eternity. Let's take a quick roll call. A travel ban, a rollback of transgender troops in the military, healthcare, and we haven't even made it to tax reform. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. We've spent the past few months helping you make sense of what some of these policy shifts mean to your bottom line. So we're going to look back on a couple of those stories, a little refresher, if you will, starting with special investigations. Right now, there are three probes into President Trump's relationship with Russia. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees have one piece. Then there's another by independent special counsel Robert Mueller. Special investigations aren't new, but they can be expensive, both literally and politically. For more on the different types of inquiries, we turn to Laura Donahue, a professor at Georgetown Law.
Previously, what we've had are called independent counsel, and that was under the Ethics in Government Act, which was introduced after the Saturday Night Massacre when Nixon ordered the prosecutor to be fired. As you will recall, the attorney general then resigned, the deputy attorney general resigned, and ultimately Congress decided in response to that to introduce legislation to make it possible for a three-judge panel to appoint somebody to look into serious matters. But the problem that came along was partly economic in terms of the costs of these special prosecutors. So over the next few decades, there were 20 different prosecutors that were appointed, and they costed a lot of money, as it turned out. So the Clinton administration was subject to five different investigations by special prosecutors, and the costs of this were just tremendous. So, as you might recall, the 4.5-year inquiry into Whitewater, and then it was expanded to include Lewinsky, came to $39.2 million. Wow. So, and then there are these other investigations that went into the Clinton administration, both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. There were four additional inquiries. So, together with that Starr investigation, it came to $79.3 million. And so Congress was very concerned about the cost of this, about the politics of having somebody independent kind of being able to go on witch hunts after senior administration officials. And so in 1999, they allowed those powers to lapse. And that's when we get the second kind of counsel, which is a special counsel, which the Department of Justice's regulations allow for the Attorney General to appoint somebody in a similar capacity.
You know, you were listing some of those costs, and We were just looking at the math. You mentioned, you know, $39.2 million for Whitewater. If you go back to Iran-Contra, Lawrence Walsh, the prosecutor there, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $47 million. But then there are things like the bipartisan 9/11 Commission, which was created by Congress. Is there a way to judge the idea of return on investment for taxpayers of these investigations, or does that just sort of depend on where you sit politically?
So I think that's very difficult to determine because some of the issues that are at stake are not easily quantifiable, like rule of law or accumulation of power or separation of powers or corruption. You know, it's very hard to put a number on that. Certainly since the beginning.
I guess you could say rule of law is priceless.
Yeah, right. Exactly. This is what we stand for as a country. So, you know, even years and years ago, back to Ulysses S. Grant in 1875, when he appointed John Henderson to look at the whiskey ring scandal, the point of a special prosecutor was to try to get rid of corruption at the highest levels of government. It's an absolutely critical function in a democracy to be able to have somebody who's independent and outside the power structure to be able to look at this, reveal what's going on, and hold people accountable for their actions.
Who controls the purse strings in sort of these different flavors of investigations?
So in a special counsel investigation, the Attorney General has a tremendous amount of authority. The Attorney General sets the parameters of the jurisdiction. The Attorney General appoints the individual. The Attorney General can actually reject any prosecutorial recommendation or any findings of that special counsel. So it was a slightly different situation with regard to the Ethics in Government Act that previously operated and has now expired. One of the problems that we found from that is that these investigations did tend to go on for quite some time. As you mentioned before, we have there was one investigation by Lawrence Walsh on Iran-Contra that went on for 8 years, and it came to, you know, $47.4 million. That money goes to salaries, to travel, to rent, to supplies, to private outside contractors, to the various agents, various agencies and government. And so one of the suggestions that was made in considering whether to renew the Ethics in Government Act in 1999 was whether the Congress should put a time limit on the length of these investigations that would help to cabin the amount of money spent, or even put a spending cap on these investigations. So if Congress wanted to introduce new legislation to cover a special counsel, these might be ways to get a hold of the spending and try to prevent kind of that extraordinary spending that can come with special counsel, while still allowing the highest officials in the government to be held accountable for their actions.
Laura Donahue is a professor at Georgetown Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Months have been dominated by debating healthcare and what might happen to the Affordable Care Act. And here on the show, we've brought you different slices of that debate and drilled down into what it means for you as employers, employees, and individuals. One very specific part of the healthcare system that is under tremendous strain, care at home. I'm talking about someone who helps an elderly, disabled, or recently hospitalized person get through their day, whether it's a bath, help taking their meds, even eating. The kind of care that Tim Ortiz, a certified nursing assistant in North Carolina, gives. He's been working with people with disabilities for 10 years. He loves his job, but says,
there's no prospect for me to continue doing this work and make any more money than I make, which is not very much. It's not enough to, you know, to live on my own or to have a family or anything like that.
13 million Americans got home care in the year 2000. The Centers for Disease Control says that will more than double by 2050, even as agencies across the country are having trouble finding people to do this work. The average pay for a home health aide is about $10 an hour. Barbara Cano works as a home health aide, both for an agency, where she makes $10.50 an hour, and then at home for free with her 85-year-old father. She also took care of her mother, who died in January.
It's very emotional and rewarding at the same time, because I know my father needs me there. My mother needed me there as well. I have siblings, so they did help with my mother. And we share in the care for my father as well. I'm the eldest of nine, so I'm used to taking care of people. On the other hand, taking care of somebody that you're not related to is a little bit different. Try not to get the emotional ties, but it's hard not to as well.
What do you think someone listening to us have this conversation might not understand about the kind of work that you do?
That it is difficult. Some people think, oh, you take care of old people all day. They don't do anything. They just sit there. But you have to be constantly on your toes and aware, because sometimes they move quickly and try and get up out of bed, or they're very confused and don't know what's going on. And we have to play it by ear. She'll ask me, what is today? Today's Saturday. Oh, good, I don't have to go to school today. So she's regressing. So she thinks she's in school. She asks me for her parents. And sometimes I don't know, do I tell her, well, your parents are no longer here. Your parents have passed. And I have told her at times, you know, your parents passed many years ago. You're 91 years old. And she'll say, no, that's not possible. It's not possible. I can't be. I want to call my mother. I want to talk to my father. So it's hard not to get emotionally involved with things like that.
Does it ever make you angry, or does it feel unfair that you're caring for someone in a moment of need and you are compensated at, say, you know, $10.50 an hour?
It does, because I would think somebody's care and life would be worth more than that. It's difficult. I'm on a very tight budget. I was working up to 4 years ago when I stopped working to take care of my parents, and I was earning a decent living. So I've had to adjust and just to think that what we earn does really not compensate for what we do. But I've accepted that because it all allows me to care for my father as well.
What do you think is sort of the biggest issue that faces people who do the kind of work you do professionally?
Probably that we're not compensated. It's almost like taking care of a baby, sometimes depending on the person's dementia and how advanced it is. But I just think about these athletes who get paid millions of dollars to do what they do, their God-given talent that they have. And sometimes they complain and they pout about not getting compensated for what they do. Well, I feel that as caregivers, we're not compensated for what we do. I work for this company, and I know it's a challenge for them as well because they have more and more clients. They can't even keep up with the demand sometimes of people wanting to do this work. People I know go and they apply for these jobs thinking, oh, I'm going to go take care of this little old lady or this little old man. And they don't last because they can't do it. When I first started with the client I have now, my first month there, she must have gone through 10 different caregivers who just couldn't handle it.
Wow.
It is a lot. Hours are long. I work 12-hour shifts on Sundays because really nobody wants to take those shifts. And it takes away from my personal things that I want to do with my family as well.
Does all of this experience make you think about what's going to happen when you get older?
It does. It does. And although I never thought it as a complaint to take care of my mother, and I know she would say, I'm sorry you have to take care of me. I'm sorry you have to do this. I said, it's okay, Mom. You know, you took care of all of us as children. It's okay. But on the same note, I wouldn't want anybody to have to take care of me that way. You know, I just hope that I'm healthy enough and hope that I wouldn't have to be in that same position.
Barbara Cano, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So many of you contacted us about this story, and we're collecting your experiences of healthcare in the United States. You can email us, weekend@marketplace.org, or leave us a voicemail message. Our number is 1-800-648-5114. Summer is all about long days, fun in the sun, and weddings. Whether you tie the knot at the courthouse, on a boat, at a fancy pants hotel, or in your backyard, saying I do is costly in time and, of course, money. So it's no surprise that the U.S. wedding industry brings in about $80 billion, yes, with a B, dollars a year. Think about it. You have the venues, the florists, caterers, tent rental companies, dressmakers. There is a lot that goes into that big day. So we're going to spend a little time on weddings, starting with David Wood, president of the Association of Bridal Consultants. Back in 2015, he joined me to talk about the wedding industry and how to make the price of a wedding fit into a budget.
Depending on what you include, it's a little over $80
billion. $80
billion? Yes, ma'am. And that's not just total. That's every single year domestic U.S. wedding industry.
What fits under that umbrella?
Really, everything a bride or a groom would spend money on. And it's a frighteningly large industry and one of the last fragmented industries where there's no single behemoth taking over everything.
So how much money are we talking about? Because you look at average numbers and they're somewhere in the $30,000 range for an American wedding, but that doesn't really give you what median spending is.
Sure. It's kind of like, I think of it as, you know, what is the average family, if you will? 2.4 children, but nobody has 2.4 children. So I think people are spending, you know, let's say in the middle of the country, $10,000 to $12,000, if even that much. And then if you look at the urban centers, you know, here in New York, Chicago, West Coast, you know, you're quickly $70,000, $80,000.
Wow. That's a lot of money. I went back and looked at some of the historical numbers, and even during the Depression, people were spending, adjusted for inflation, about $5,000, which was a quarter of household income then. Now it's closer to half, but it tells you that Americans love spending money on weddings. Why? You've been doing this for a while. Why do we love this so much?
Sure. I think we enjoy the big show. In the 40s and 50s, we had needs and we manufactured products to fill the needs. Now I think we've switched things in this country. We have some products or some ideas, and then we go out and manufacture the needs. So we've convinced people that for some reason they have to have these enormous celebrations.
There are a number of trade shows. Your organization is involved in a lot of these trade shows, and you see the things that people spend money on. I gather there is a phrase people refer to brides as drunken sailors.
Well, that would insult several drunken sailors because they're even worse than that. But we love them. Our organization, we happen to be the biggest. We're in all 50 states and 31 countries. And don't forget, overseas, they're also losing their minds. But that's fine. At the end of the day, you give the customer what they want. Domestically, though, we have 2.4 million weddings every year. And people are going to even longer lead times. You know, some of the things that have changed recently, we've tracked. People are getting married later. You know, we're up to, we used to be kind of 24-ish on the bride, 26 on the groom. We're now as high as late 20s, 29 on the bride, 31 on the groom. And they're planning as far as a year and a half out, which unfortunately is sometimes longer than the marriage itself. But we build it for them. Yeah. The first thing they choose.
Wait, do you feel uncomfortable about that? You see somebody maybe going into debt thinking, I don't know, this thing might fall apart.
Exactly. You know, we try to tell them, don't go into debt over this. $30,000 is an awful lot of money to spend on a Saturday afternoon. You know, that could be a nice deposit on a one-bedroom starter condo somewhere. But that's not what people want.
How long have you been in this business?
About 15 years ago. You know, I had a real job for many, many years, which was wonderful, but then wanted to work for myself and looked at an awful lot of industries. And my goofy background, if I may, I studied math at Dartmouth and have a MBA from Harvard. And I said, geez, what's out there that may not have matured the way other industries have? And as you look around, you see this enormous industry that's still filled with a collection of entrepreneurs, thus the wedding industry.
And so what have you seen over those 15 years and how the industry has grown and changed?
There are higher expectations by the buyer. You know, we have a very sophisticated buyer today. Information is everywhere. If anything, we're drowning in it. But that buyer, which is pretty much the bride, is not as much the parents anymore. You know, we build based on who's paying for the event. So what we have seen is actually some unrealistic expectations in terms of what they want, because we all see it, all these choices, but people don't realize how expensive they are. So we have to bring a bit of a reality check and really be the budget enforcer.
Something that our listeners wrote us about was the wedding markup, that if you, say, tell a venue that you're having a party, that's one price. You tell them that you're having a wedding, it's 20%, 25% more expensive. What's going on there?
Yeah, good question. But I think today's buyer is also aware of that. And we shop the choices. I mean, we really put the venues in competition.
But why is it more expensive for a wedding?
Oh, just because they think that you are a one-time buyer and they think you're a very emotional buyer, both of which are true. Using a wedding planner, we're able to shop places a little bit more. And also, our wedding planners might be doing 10 or 12 weddings a year, we will actually get better pricing from a venue as a repeat supplier or a band or a caterer than a one-time retail buyer might get.
When you look at weddings vis-a-vis the economy as a whole, how do they fit into economic cycles?
Yeah, well, we can't figure that out because they don't they don't track each other. Wedding spending, and to God's ears, has continued independent of the economy. Now, it doesn't roar up in good economies and it doesn't drop off in weaker economies. I mean, you may not have as much of an over-the-top, but you're still going to have the celebration because most people think, as most are, a one-time big event in your life.
David Wood is president of the Association of Bridal Consultants. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, if you really don't want to shell out the average 30 grand for a wedding, there is another way. Elope. No table plans, no flower orders, just the wedding. But eloping does not have to be short on fun. For a couple $100, great officiants in Long Beach, California can make your day extra special. Imagine getting married in front of Elvis, Marilyn Monroe, or even a Star Wars character. Intrigued? Founder Alan Katz stopped by and told me a little about his business.
I marry people. For lack of any better words, I marry people for a living. But I do it a little differently than you would imagine.
Like how?
Well, I have a 24-hour wedding chapel, and I also do fun themed weddings. And every wedding that we do, we make it a fun celebration instead of that boring wedding that you've always seen.
I see. So I gather that a lot of people kind of semi-elope to your chapel.
Absolutely. Every day we have couples come in 24 hours a day. They make an appointment, they come in, and they come in for a variety of different reasons.
Well, what are the reasons?
We've had many different types of couples. Couples that want to come in, they've been talking about it all day. Let's just do it now. And they spontaneously come in. I had a couple the other couple months ago come in. And they called me at 3 in the morning. I show up at 4. I'm like, why are you here so late? He has to report to prison at 6.
Oh, okay.
I'm doing more weddings than I've ever done before. I've absolutely assembled a team of 33 officiants to do weddings because I couldn't handle them all.
So I took a quick look online at your price list. Why don't you run me through the packages you have?
Sure. For just coming into the chapel quickly, it's $299 for the marriage license and the wedding ceremony. Bada bing, you're out in and out in 30 minutes or less. If you want us to go on location to do a wedding, then we start at around $395 and we go up from there depending on what we get to do, whether it's just a customized ceremony or a complete themed wedding.
Yeah, well, what kind of themed weddings have you done?
Oh, boy. You name it. I've done everything from Star Wars weddings, dressed up like Austin Powers. I do a lot of Elvis weddings. I'm an Elvis wedding impersonator.
I saw online you did the Mowage
yes.
one from The Princess Bride.
Actually, I get a lot of requests for even just that line, but sometimes they want me to dress up in the whole cardinal outfit. So I put it on. I'm absolutely that character throughout at least the beginning part of the wedding and then go into the other parts of the wedding.
How has business been and how is it now?
You know, in tough economic times, people get married. And in affluent times, people get married. People get married at all times. So marriage doesn't slow down. Marriage doesn't speed up. What does change is the size of the wedding and the perks. I've had people come in for meetings. They were going to have the big wedding at the big hotel and, you know, hundreds of people. And they come in, they talk to them. They go, you know, let's just do it right now.
Why do you think that is?
It's so much of a hassle to put a wedding together sometimes. It costs a lot of money. I had a couple say the other day, oh, my God, weddings are expensive. And I'm like, yeah, they are. You're throwing the biggest party of your lifetime, and some people don't want to have to go through that expense. Some people would rather spend that $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 on something they can actually use instead of just a two-hour memory.
You know, you run a 24-hour business. Who comes in at 1 in the morning? I mean, are they sober?
Oh, yeah. I won't do a wedding for somebody who's drunk. I've had people walk in, and they were drunk, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I can't really do this. But there were just people who were sitting on the couch. Maybe they were watching a romantic movie at home. And they're like, you know, we've talked about this. Let's see if there's a place we can go. Let's go to Vegas. And then in their searches through the internet, they come across my website. And they go, wow, there's this place in Long Beach, California that I can get married right now. I don't even have to go to Vegas. I don't have to worry about getting a license because they issue them right there in their office.
And how has your business changed with same-sex marriage being legal?
A, it's been a boon. I love marrying all couples, but I specifically love marrying couples who had been denied the right to marry in the past. And when it first came out in 2008, we did tons of weddings and we were the go-to people. When it came back within the industry, within the wedding industry in Southern California, everybody knew that my company was the company that people go to. Because I teach classes, I show people how to work with same-sex couples to show them how to really understand what their needs are and to really cater to their special desires of being recognized. And I love it when I see couples walk into my office who have been denied all their lives and get them to say I do. It's the most amazing feeling.
What's the most popular themed wedding that you guys do?
Probably the most popular themed wedding, if I had to choose any of them, probably would be Elvis. Elvis is still up there.
Everybody still wants an Elvis wedding, huh?
That's it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Couldn't resist.
I know.
You couldn't resist.
It was there. It's been waiting to come out all interview.
Fair enough. Alan Katz is the owner of Great Officiants in Long Beach, California. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
regardless of whether you go all out on that big day or, you know, keep things low-key, there is almost always the question of gifts. What to ask for, what to give, and how much. So we brought in an expert to help you out, Carolyn Hacks. She's an etiquette and advice columnist. And I started out by asking her, is there such a thing as wedding gift etiquette today?
Well, I should say yes, but I don't believe in it anymore. So, I mean, I believe in etiquette because it's the one thing that keeps people from having to guess and inadvertently offending people. But I think with wedding gifts, so much has changed and so quickly that right now it's a little bit of a free-for-all.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're hearing from the people who have called us and written us. Do you get the gift from the registry or do you eschew the registry forever?
Well, I think you do whatever works for you. If somebody has a registry and you believe in buying something material, then go ahead and buy something off it. But I think it's a real challenge right now for people getting married because a lot of people aren't getting married at 21 when they have absolutely nothing. And the stuff that people use to stock a home is actually, it's dropped in price, relative price, for years. And so we have cheap stuff and people are getting married later. And a lot of people just don't want things. And at the same time, they don't want to offend their guests. So you've got this whole crossroads right now where people don't really want anything, but they're not supposed to ask for anything other than what's on the registry, which they don't even ask for directly. I mean, the way I look at it now is like the one thing you can't do is ask for money, and the one thing you should do is give money.
Well, you're going to have to explain that to me. I mean, you still have the kind of like, it's tacky to ask for money feeling?
Yes. Oh, I can't stand it. I can't say you just can't. I mean, everybody knows that it would be nice to have money, right? I mean, who doesn't want it? And even the people who absolutely don't need it and don't want it can donate it somewhere. It's beautiful. It fits everything, every situation, you know, it's universal. The people who want experiences can use it on experiences. The people who need stuff can use it to furnish their homes. And people who don't need it and don't want it can give it away. It's beautiful. But again, you can't ask for it because it's just incredibly tacky.
Well, then that puts people in a weird bind, right? I mean, why is our culture so hung up on this? I was talking to a Nigerian friend about his wedding, and he was like, oh, well, it's super normal in Nigeria to ask for and get money.
Right. Well, again, it's just, I think it's, I mean, maybe I'm just stuck on this one point. I really think your surrogates can probably say it for you. You know what? They could just get them a check. But I don't think you can say, give me money. I don't know. I choke on it.
We've encountered a couple of different views of the registry. Some people have said, oh, I put on there, you know, the things we might actually want every day and the things our friends could probably afford. And other people have said, well, gosh, this might be the chance to shoot for the stars and get the $400 sheet set that is beautiful. And if someone springs for it, great. Where do you come down on that?
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the, hey, if people are going to buy it for me, I'll take it. But I think one of the ways that you can inoculate yourself against doing the wrong thing with a registry is keep it streamlined and provide a good range. So if you've got somebody who can only spare $25 on something, have something there. And if you have people who are looking for something big, then have something there. But it's sort of like the key to life is just if you're not sure what to do, just tell yourself, okay, don't be a jerk. And I think if you're putting together your registry and you just have that little voice in your head saying, don't be a jerk, you could probably come down in some sort of range of acceptability.
Does the fanciness of a wedding or, say, the length that a bride and groom or bride and bride, groom and groom have gone to, does that influence at all what you give?
Oh, no. Is this the you have to cover the plate question? That's another one that drives me bananas. The idea that
well,
the gift has to equal.
Is that a going theory?
Well, some people really believe that. I've actually gotten mail from brides or grooms who are really offended by a gift because it didn't even come close to covering what they paid for the catering for that person to come. And I'm thinking, oh, that's just so mercenary. First of all, wedding gifts are not required. Any gift is a gesture of generosity. It is not a requirement. And that's rule number one. And that's where I do believe etiquette has a place. Etiquette says gifts are never required. When you do give a gift, you give based on what you want to give somebody and what you're able to give somebody. And that's it. It has nothing to do with the hospitality you've been shown. The hospitality is what the bride and groom want to give, and the gift is what the guest wants to give, and that's it. They're independent.
Carolyn Hax, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Because we're Marketplace, we love to do the numbers. And here on The Weekend Show, we use them to put the events of the week in context. So with that, here are producers Tony Wagner and Sarah Menendez to bring us this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
97.
That's the percentage of Amtrak riders Lyft says it reaches in the U.S.
The rideshare company is partnering with Amtrak to offer train passengers a way to and from the station.
It seems like everyone is capitalizing on solutions for the so-called last mile.
And now Amtrak riders can use the Amtrak app to request a ride home.
$175,000.
That's the price of a vintage Rolex sold by the watch site Hodinkee.
The sale set a record for the site, and it may not have happened without Instagram.
Watches have become super popular on the image sharing app. Hodinkee has over 378,000 followers.
Zero.
That's how many humans understand a language created by two Facebook chatbots.
The artificial intelligence programs named Alice and Bob were designed to learn how to negotiate, trade, and barter.
Facebook was forced to shut down the robots after they developed their own language for negotiating.
The tech giant says their chatbots are making progress towards being able to function as personalized digital assistants.
Branding and advertising are all around us. Billboards, commercials, logos, they're ubiquitous. And we hear them, too, sometimes without even knowing it. Like when a stranger next to you on the plane powers up a laptop, somehow your brain knows it's running Windows. Or when a phone rings and you recognize the default Apple ringtone. Brands hope you associate positive things with their sonic ID. Can you guess this one? Yes, HBO wants you to remember its programming when it plays its feature presentation score before a new original movie. And, of course, you know this one. Connor Moore is a musician who does sound design for brands. He's worked with Amazon, PayPal, and Uber Rush. And I asked him to explain what sonic branding is and what it does.
The way that I really like to think about it is that every brand has a personality. So we as sound designers, composers, how can we communicate that by using sound or voice or music? You know, you played all those sonic IDs. Another example is like Intel Inside. Everyone knows that. Or the THX sonic ID.
Yep.
But, you know, now we're moving into a space where we can really start to branch out, you know, create assets for things like product sounds, voice for products or voice for advertisements. They really all fall under the umbrella of sonic branding. And they should, you know, these are all opportunities to create a more cohesive brand experience that is both strategic and intentional.
I mean, I guess as a consumer, sometimes you're not thinking about the amount of work that, you know, went into something like that. But when you hear that HBO sound, it is priming your brain for like, okay, now I'm going to sit down and like really watch something fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it really inspires that kind of awe that sucks you into the cinematic experience. And, you know, that's a it's a cool example you picked because I don't know if you remember, but, you know, I'm a kid from the 80s watching in you know, the mid-80s, HBO used to have this intro that they played before all their films, and it was this super dramatic intro that had this big, you know, score to it. It was about a minute long,
yeah.
But yeah. So they've actually,
like,
you know,
swooped around.
Exactly. Totally takes me back. Very nostalgic moment. But they've actually continued that that DNA, if you will, that sonic theme, but in a much more subtle way today. So after you hear that initial sound logo that you played, it segues into a cue that, you know, was created in the early 80s. So, you know, it's really cool to see how some of these brands are evolving sound in more subtle ways, too.
I want to talk with you about a piece of your work. So we're going to play, I believe, a ringtone for the Amazon Fire phone. Let's play that. So you made that, right?
I was a creative director for that.
When you hear that noise, what does it evoke in you?
Serenity. You know, one thing that I think a lot of people dislike about ringtones is they're very jarring. You know, they can really grab people's attention in a negative way. So one of the things we tried to do was create a sense of wonder, but also of serenity. You know, we didn't want to jump out and become annoying to users.
You know, it didn't occur to me until I was preparing for this interview, but every time somebody's cell phone rings, I mean, that is, in a sense, advertising.
Absolutely. It's, you know, the audio version of a billboard.
Well, when you talk about the Fire Phone, for example, okay, we played one ringtone, but then there is a whole suite of sounds that goes along with a product like that. Mm-hmm. Do you sit down as a creative director and think, this is the identity I want the phone to have? And how do you translate that into sound?
I mean, it's a whole process. You know, initially you go in and you go into a project discovery, right? Discovering what the brand is about, what the product is about. So you take, you know, concepts of their brand identity that has already been shaped, and you're also looking at, you know, taking cues from the visual experience or the industrial design in order to shape this through sounds. You know, the way that I see this is visual artists using type fonts or color schemes. We use timbre of instruments, keys in music or modes or melodies in order to create these color palettes. So, you know, it's really interesting, and it's a hard thing that I've learned over time is how can you create these feelings of, say, serenity, for example? What does that mean?
Well, because sound is so intimate, I think, in a way that other media aren't.
It is a very intimate thing. I think music has the ability to connect to people like most mediums don't. It's really impactful as far as like nostalgia, remembering an experience that you went through, and it takes you right back there. It also brings recall, brand recall. It's a very powerful tool for brands to use. You know, like you played the iPhone ringtone. I take Bart into the city every day, and you hear that, you know it's an Apple phone immediately. You hear a Nokia, you know, ringtone, you know that's a Nokia phone. So, you know, the intimacy of sound and music is a really powerful tool for brand recall.
How is this going to become even more important as we start to get more and more devices that talk to each other? You know, I can imagine a universe in which your Samsung fridge talks to your phone, talks to your dishwasher.
Right, right. We're starting to move away from the visual user interface. You're seeing products like Amazon Echo come in. Moving forward, I think a lot of these devices are going to exist around us, and the way we're going to communicate them is by sound, you know, whether it be voice or sound design. Sound is going to become even more of a huge player in terms of product and technology. You know, we as experts in this field have to really be careful about how we create this and where it is used. Part of my job is to say, okay, we don't need 100 sounds. Let's do 10, you know, and just strip it back, because ultimately you don't want to have every device in your home telling you this, that, or the other, or beeping at you. You know, you want to be very selective of these things and do it tastefully.
What does it cost to make a great Sonic logo?
What we recommend is to, you know, people that work in this field is not to just approach it from a Sonic ID perspective necessarily. It's more of a bigger brand build out. There are clients certainly that come along and they just need a product sound, for example, or a Sonic ID. So we take those jobs on as well. The bigger projects that, you know, include Sonic ID, a bigger strategy, discovery process, as well as product sound, those type of projects can take upwards of a year, and they can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars,
wow,
right? Whereas smaller projects can certainly be in the tens of thousands.
One of the things you talked about with California Sunday Magazine was cars and the sound that, you know, electric vehicles make or will be making, which kind of blew my mind because, right, they don't sound like combustion engine cars. Can you explain the difference between, I don't know, what a Dodge Charger sounds like and a Nissan Leaf sounds like?
It's interesting because when you think about it, an internal combustion engine, some of them are very loud and very obnoxious. So this is an opportunity to create something more pleasant. and branded to that particular car or that particular company. I think the Leaf is a really cool example. You know, they've done a lot of work with their actual internal sound UI as well, outside of the engine tone. And it's been a very strategic effort for them that I think they've had a lot of success with.
So when this thing rolls down the street, like, what am I going to hear? And will some part of my lizard brain know that it's a Nissan Leaf?
I think so, especially as the, you know, the landscape fills out a little bit more. The Nissan Leaf is a very lightweight engine tone. It's almost a whir, like kind of wind. And there's a lot of opportunity for the future of electric cars. As far as what do cars sound like, you know, going from internal combustion engines to kind of blue sky right now, we as composers and sound designers are pretty excited about what that could be.
Connor Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
We like to do here is ask people from the world of the arts, whether they're actors, writers, musicians, whatever, about their experiences with work and money, what's shaped them, and what they've learned along the way.
Hey, I'm Eric Andre, and you can't spell American Dream without Eric Andre.
All right, first question.
Yes.
Fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you
pizza.
Next question. What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
I'll tell you, I bought a house a year and a half ago. And right after I bought it, like a few months went by, and I was like, I want to move back to New York City. Why did I buy an LA house? And it was a lot of money. And I was like, I don't want to live here anymore. You know, it's funny. Almost every comedian I started out with moved to LA, except for my two friends, Hannibal Buress and Amy Schumer. And my two friends that are doing the best in comedy, the most successful friends I have, are Hannibal Buress and Amy Schumer. And they were just both like, no, I'm not going to move to LA. I love New York. I'm staying in New York. And I was like, nah, you got this years ago. I'm like, you got to, man. You ain't going to make it out in New York. You got to move to LA. And they were both like, nah, I think I'm fine. I think I'm going to do fine sticking it out in New York. And I was like, man, you two don't know what you're talking about. And now they are millionaires. So I was like, maybe they're onto something. And I think New York as a comedian is just healthier for you. Keeps your edge. I was planning to move back to New York. That was my plan. And then I just got stuck here.
When did you realize comedy could be a career?
I think a few weeks ago. I'm always afraid that it's going to end or I'm going to mess something up. Or fail, and it doesn't feel like secure. This is the most job security I've felt since I started, and I still feel like I gotta continue pounding the pavement or it's just gonna vanish and dry up. So,
do you remember your first paying gig?
First paying gig, I got $20. I played at some really weird venue. I don't even remember the venue. I just remember it was the last stop on the A train. It was like the Far Rockaways, Queens. And there was like an audience of like three people. And I think they gave me a check. And I thought about framing the check. And I never did. Because I needed $20. I was like, this is like three meals right here.
What is something everyone should own no matter the cost?
I bought this book called Healing Back Pain. That kind of saved my life, by Dr. John Sarno. Basically, you have all these physical ailments, back pain, colitis, ulcers. Your body manifests all these physical symptoms because it's trying to create distractions from unwanted repressed emotions in your subconscious mind. It's like a defense mechanism. So through therapy and journaling, basically taking all the repressed anger and rage and upsetting emotions that you kind of are always playing on a loop in the background in your unconscious mind, voluntarily bringing those to your conscious mind through therapy and through journaling, your body no longer needs to create defense mechanisms because you're coping. Changed my life. I had like horrible back pain from when I was like 18 to like a year ago. It helped with my work. I think journaling is actually like a key to success. You can have set clear goals for yourself. You can start noticing repetitive behavior patterns and see like the type of things that are springing up that keep bothering you and keep bothering you. And then you can have a bird's eye view of it. And it's just totally in all aspects of my life has bettered my life.
What advice do you wish someone had given you before you started comedy?
To not be so hard on myself and embrace the process and realize that it's like a career in comedy is like learning how to swim. You know, when the swim instructor would just throw you in the pool as a little kid and you'd have to like fight for your life to get out of the water and breathe air. That's kind of what comedy is like. And it's a ton of failure and rejection for like the first 10 years. It's what makes you professional. It makes you able to cope with any crappy situation. But I was miserable for the first 10 years doing this. This is really hard. It's really hard. I'm so shocked that I got anywhere because I was so broke and so confused and depressed and anxious.
Well, you made it.
I made it out alive.
Good job.
Hopefully. I think I did.
That was comedian Eric Andre speaking with Marketplace producer Haley Hirschman. And you can listen to some of our past Marketplace quizzes with the likes of Mark Duplass, Zoe Deschanel, Moby, former White House photographer Pete Souza. Just go to our website, marketplace.org. Next week on Marketplace Weekend, we talk education. With back-to-school season right around the corner, we look into the financial burden of returning to the classroom for parents and for teachers. You can send us your questions and stories. We're weekend@marketplace.org. And we'll have a special report from Detroit and a case that could have implications for schools across the country.
Probably most of them, to be honest, like probably can't sit there and read a real 12th grade novel or something like that. I probably can't even, because my last couple of years, I don't think that my reading skills have advanced that much. It's not that they're dumb. It's just they haven't been taught the 9th through 12th grade necessities, and it probably goes back before that, too.
The economy, education, and a right to literacy. That's next time on Marketplace Weekend. And that is it for our show this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Alyssa Dudley. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our vice president and general manager. Adrian Hill will be sitting in the host chair all next week. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.